For our next presentation, we're going to move to a northern suburb of Chicago, a small town by the name of Milwaukee. Joshua Lane is a graduate student in fingerstyle guitar performance at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. Boy, they didn't have majors like that when I was in college.
No, they didn't.
Since 2009, he has managed the Laboratory for the Digital Conversion and Analysis of Historic and Contemporary Media Related to Fingerstyle Guitar. Since 2010, he has been research lead on the Avant-Garde Coffeehouse Project. He specializes in harnessing contemporary technologies to refocus the conventions of transcription practice and notation and to enable greater explication of idiosyncratic guitar techniques. This work inspires new methodological approaches to both fingerstyle guitar pedagogy and criticism. And we're going to hear some Reverend Gary Davis in this presentation. So the title of the presentation is Transcription of Archival Recordings from the Avant-Garde Coffee House.
Just give me 1 second here to... lost my mouse. Oh, and that's why. I've got my mouse. So, a brief backstory to this. I started working with John Stropes, the director of guitar studies, as a student, but then volunteered myself to become involved with a lot of what he's done personally. Much of what we study in fingerstyle guitar, contemporary composers like Leo Kottke and Michael Hedges, John Fahey, he's been, in particularly in the case of Leo Kottke, been videotaping him since 1982. And part of that is to build transcriptions that both describe sound and then prescribe how to play them, because it's the essence of fingerstyle is movement of hands, and how the hands move create pitches, notes, and things like that. How to display it on a page is sometimes very difficult in the case of Michael Hedges, but if any of you are interested in what that looks like, you can get a John Strope's book, Rhythm, Sonority, Silence. But the university moved the guitar department to Kenilworth Square East, which is a quarter mile south of the campus, but it also overlooks this building that from 1962 to 1968 was a coffee house in Milwaukee. And we heard, you know, whispers and rumors of, you know, things that occurred there and artists that played there, and there are a few extant posters. And so we decided to get a little curious, and we went after one of the owners that was still, there are two owners that still survive. And we met with him in 2010. And he brought with him a DAT tape of Skip James playing at the Avant-Garde, and that kind of blew our minds. We were thinking more recordings of local performers and maybe a few smaller touring artists or people from Chicago. But that really opened our eyes to what the possibility of what was out there was. And this is where it is. And now normally this is how it goes. So I say the Avant-Garde Coffee House. And if you're over 20 or under 30, I say it's a block south of Urban Outfitters. If you're over 30, it's two blocks south of Whole Foods. And if you're over 55, you'd actually tell me where it is. That's been an interesting because I've got to interact. We actually had a class this semester, which was a little nerve-wracking because two of the owners were students in the class. So there was a certain drive to get it right. This, let's see here. This is actually video, no sound. A local filmmaker, Bill Olson, shot this in 1966. And it's just a sort of couple days at the Avant-Garde. It's a little dark, but it shows, that's the famous address, 2111 North Prospect. in the famous sort of light fixture, and that's a young Dave Ray from Kerner Ray and Glover before his accident. And Kerner Ray and Glover were actually one of the first performers, major performers. Their first record, Blues, Rags and Hollers, was recorded in Milwaukee, and that evening they played at the Avant Garde for the first time. And I think they played there in part or in whole, Kerner and Ray and or Glover, as they would say, through 1966. But a couple of the other performers and some images from the Avant Garde itself. This is Big Joe Williams. I think this is one of the first performances, and he, of all the tapes we have, there's 474 tracks that are of him, and about a third of them are actually indexed. The rest of them have no title. They're just file names. That's part of my job. This is Sleepy John Estes and his son. This is upstairs at Hooligans, which is a local bar. But at the time, it was a crash pad, so a lot of visiting artists would stay there, and photographs have emerged from that. This is Magic Sam playing in 68. I think the first time, it's always sketchy knowing how many times and when, and that stuff we may never know. But this has a specific date on it. I think he played 6 to 7 times in 1968. This is a photograph of Johnny Young and a few local people. And the guy on the right is Charlie Musselwhite, who recently put out a record with Ben Harper. But he was the go-to guy for Chicagoans. We'd send somebody down to find Charlie, and then he would go to any bars and try to find somebody to bring back to Milwaukee. And I think for a while he lived in the same place Big Joe did. And that was probably the link to Big Joe. New Lost City Ramblers played there in 67. I mean, these are all photographs from the place. This is part of the Innova Gallery at UWM allowed us to do a gallery exhibition of, you know, part of the process, not only audio, was photographs, like 400. And then it was, let's find the negatives and let's start scanning. And it was a lot of fun. You know, this is a local band, and this is part of the demise, too, as the 60s rolled on, bands became electric, and the neighbors didn't like it. And eventually, the club, or the coffee house closed, you know, as a basic license renewal sort of deal. The county, or the city, didn't want to renew the license, because there was too much trouble. Bands like this, the Velvet Whip. This is fun to Photoshop. This was like a performance art band. And there, you know, we recently had the guy who's sitting into lecture. He's a strange guy, but really nice and told us a lot. And, you know, this is like people say the Velvet Whip, you know, destroyed the avant-garde or something like that. But in fact, they were bringing in the money. They're very popular locally. And we do have some of their music too. All these photos, except for the New Lost City Ramblers, we have recordings of. And we're going to go to some of the tapes. Now, an interesting story about the tapes is such. Gordy handed us the DAT tape, and he said, I had this transferred in 1992, and I haven't been able to listen to it. I don't have a DAT machine. So we said, well, we got one, which we didn't know if we had one, but we found one. And we got it to him, and of course that started a good relationship. But a lot of these recordings have been transferred to DAT in the 90s. And then in the early 2000s, somebody transferred them just to digital files. So in some cases, we have the original tape, the digital transfers from the early 2000s, and DAT transfers that were made in 92. Early 90s, I should say. Now, we haven't actually done anything to the tapes, and we're still dealing with what it is we should do, because they're not in good condition. And some of them, the last transfer, it didn't go well for some of them. This is, the previous was Big Joe. This is Johnny Shines and Big Walter Horton. Book of White, played there a few times. Mississippi Fred McDowell. Aside from that, Skip James, Little Brother Montgomery, Big Joe a lot, Crinoway and Glover. And I'm trying to remember, but those are the ones that my memory is really based on the folders that I see all the time, you know, and trying to go through all these things. But in 66, a new students took over briefly, one of them being Richard Weening, who poured a lot of money, you know, as much as a young student has, into the Guard, and hired a lot of people. And his first weekend was Reverend Gary Davis. And that's, you know, the other part of me is a guitar player on country blues. And the mystery that has eluded people for a long time is, how do I get to make that sound? And that's the same question I've been trying to answer too. And it really takes a lot of work, to say the least. But this is an ad from the UWM Post. It just so happens that the ad for Reverend Gary Davis is next to the article about students taking over. And I think Skip James was the following weekend, so it was a pretty good week in Milwaukee. And the thing about Skip James is it was, as far as we know, he was in the area twice, once to record for Paramount and once to play here. And it was in some of the dialogue between the songs, he talks about that experience, and it was very interesting. And this is the tape, one tape. There are two tapes of Gary Davis's. This is tape 26, the other one is 13. And as far as I can tell, again, I don't know, I have to listen to the songs to determine like what night it's from. Based on if he says a day, then I know. If he says he has to leave, then I know it's near the end of the weekend. If he says he just got there, then it's probably Friday. So it's been a mystery. And this is a common thing too. These tapes were often used and recorded over at least once or twice before they ended up with their final performances. And this one I always like to joke Gordy because he was recorded over. He was a performer there too, and I always kind of give him a little nudge every time I look at this tape box. But this is the interesting opportunity that was presented. I deal with country blues in particular, and not everyone is the same, but I deal with all of their songs more as modes or frameworks. And the live performance is really another composition within that mode. And I'm not talking like modes like scales. I'm just talking like structures. And with Gary Davis, I've done previous work. There's with a few songs, but one in particular, Samson and Delilah, probably his best known piece, maybe because of Peter, Paul, and Mary, I don't know. They recorded it. They actually got him a lot of income. It went gold within the first few months and double platinum in 86 or something like that. But this song is, he's recorded it 19, or it's been recorded 19 times. And if some of you have these handouts, the top page is actually a spiritual that this song comes from. And this was digitized by Eastman School of Music. Thank you. This was very hard. This is just part of my normal research into a piece. This is what I need to know where it comes from. He was blind. He didn't read music. It was orally. And I was trying to find a source, perhaps, for his own arrangement. And then what follows on the next two pages are, I'm talking front and back here, are all the recorded versions of just that spiritual. And there was a lot. Because I never was satisfied that, I was always told that Blind Willie Johnson was the source for his version. But I was never satisfied with it. And just, you know, this is normal. I had it, why not? If you're interested, Reverend T.T. Rose, his version of If I Had My Way is pretty close. And it's pretty good. The page that follows there is a selected discography of Reverend Gary Davis. And the point here, the large horizontal line, that's when he passed away. So this is like a look at, you know, new material that has only been released after his death. And particularly in, you know, just within the last 10 years, it's been an astounding amount. So it's coming out of the woodwork, much like these tapes have. And it's been a really interesting sort of resurgence in, you know, just as a consumer of music, I really enjoy this type of thing. But this was tabulated in trying to find all the recorded versions of Samson and Delilah. Now the page that follows that is actually the index of the tapes, his performances at the Avant-Garde. And there's a lot of conversation, a few sermons, and an interview. And it's all really, you can't put any value on it to listen to it. But as a guitar player, I got to back up here, I need to know more information. And what this presented us with is 3 days of him performing Samson and Delilah. And as just an analysis tool, I like to compare them to understand framework, okay? Because not all performances are the same. They may seem same, they may sound the same, but really it's like you have couplets and the glue between the couplets is different or something like that. And as a performer and someone who's in a university program, especially fingerstyle guitar, you're left writing your own music a lot, or I should say transcribing a lot of music, because a lot of this is unwritten. And if it is written, it isn't written well. So we used as a source a few years ago, there's a video performance of him playing this song in 1967. And this is just a general chart. The C's and V's are couplets, are four measure sections, basically containing different riffs. I don't really like that word because it homogenizes the idea of what's going on musically. And then the color is indicating pitch that he's singing, how he's ending the phrase. There's like three pitches he ended on. It was either G4, G3, or D3. And that sort of changed too as a type of expression. And here is where I'm going to do some magic, I think. We're going to look at, this is going to be V3. And I apologize for some of the line weights that are in your printed version. But this is what we sort of deal with. This is transcription of the video, V3. This is the framework that we were starting from. Now, some of this may be new to some of you. This is where I say you should get out your guitar. Did anyone? No, okay. Some of it, basically, we're really interested in hand movement. Now, as a performer, he used thumb and index with his right hand only, which presents some very interesting contexts. But his left hand, I can't really say why, but his left hand was very interesting as well. His chord shapes were sometimes difficult, but they a lot of the context they created could only be created with that chord shape. And this is just the, well, what we have here, basically this is how we don't deal with chord diagrams in general. They're too homogenizing. Here's a chord diagram and hold it down forever. It doesn't work like that. It's more like here's a bar here. And this was very common where you would have a single finger covering two strings. And I think a lot of people that I encounter, this is very difficult for them to do. Not with the index finger as much as, say, the third finger or the second finger. And this duration line is intended to show how long this is held down. So, and there's a termination point. Sometimes they don't have termination points. Sometimes they're dotted to show that there's a loosening of the chord and it creates a certain set of sounds. Ticks, you know, most people call it noise, but that's a stylistic feature. I think Charles Seeger was starting to point that out in the 50s as like we needed to get rid of the standard or the grand staff because it was too, it measured everything in half steps and there was so much sound and timbre that existed outside of that. And these boxes, you know, indicate sometimes it's a little, these are the ticks in general, this or the X here. And usually they're created by slackening of chord or a fingering or a movement from one place to another. But the funny thing about it is that this occurs so much that it just became obvious to us that this was a stylistic feature. Especially this guy right here. This one. Now, this is actually, in my mind, written poorly. And you're looking at the guy who wrote it. It's a little too ambiguous. Or actually, it's not ambiguous. It tells you too much, and it's a little less than that. We're going to go to here. And we're going to look at, you were right about being dexterous. So this is a common thing that I do. Look at spectral frequency a lot. Transcribing music, it's like a, you know, guitar in one hand, spectral frequency, sound, I use them all. I mean, I throw everything I can at it. Because, you know, as soon as I think I figure it out on guitar, then I'm like, no, that can't be right. There's no way I could do that by myself. It's kind of that feeling. So I need to check it somehow. And that tick that we're looking at, the image is a little dark, but it would actually occur right here. And this is the sound slowed down. You'll hear it at the end. Or not. Ooh. Where am I? Dandink. Now the it doesn't seem like much, but you're hearing an open third string. Hold on. I'm going to get it. There we go. The open third string. This is the open third string ringing. Now, this is sort of a Sherlock Holmes kind of thing. So you have an open third string ringing, and then you have something happening on strings, some other string, and just the context of how hands move, his hands move. This is actually the image at the same point from the video. So we could see that the index finger was actually doing something. This is actually occurring while the open third string is ringing. And this goes to the tick too, identifying like what it actually is and how it's caused. And this is actually a shot of the same thing at a different hand. And it's as simple as this. His hand, the fat of his hand in some way is cutting the string. Now, I've heard him do many difficult things and I can't assert enough that this is like an intended sound. And it's very interesting just as a person who's tried to play this quite a few times that he doesn't hit the second string. That takes a lot of attention to what you're doing. And the pattern in which which strings he's articulating, and the pattern in which it unfolds is, I think it's a little irregular. So he's reaching for something. But he never really produces a solid pitch. So we have to find a way to notate that, is the point. And what we probably have done is maybe imply too much. We're implying a first fret, because the tick itself does create pitch, and you can't identify it. And it's between like an F and an F sharp. So the best thing we could do was do it the way we did it. This section here, this will work pretty well. So another thing is, right here, these ticks themselves, how are they created? And It's not like he just went for the first string and missed. It's more like this. Oop. He's actually, this is the same spot within the video. He's muting the strings either by pushing up with his fourth finger or holding down his third finger on these. Now, how many of these he hits varies all the time. But it definitely, it's sort of like this move B.B. King does, where you hear a bent note, but you hear something else too. And there's something really interesting about it. But it's important too, what we haven't done in the music, and I think this is V.E., if I'm correct. Well, we haven't done in the music too well so far. I mean, this is all prototype. We've done things that are far more difficult, that's for sure. But this is something a little different. But what we've done, this is what you're looking at, is the beginning and VE, the beginning of measure three. And it's a strike through with the thumb and a bent note. That's not really a half step. It's somewhere in between. And that looks a little strange, but he always comes up like it's a quarter tone, basically. It's not even a quarter tone. We struggle with identifying things like that just because of the way standard notation works and tablature staff in general. Those two are still kind of linked a little too much. But that's another thing that we try to deal with. Now, these are just excerpts from the video itself. And that was a base from which we started on. And again, it was a very interesting idea to just say, okay, let's transcribe all three versions and then see what happens. You know, how often does he come up short on this? Or, you know, if he plays a wrong chord, does he reproduce it? And it helped us build a vocabulary to understanding his style. And, you know, it's never a finished product. But these are parts of the chorus. And there's a lot of interesting things that, you know, video doesn't provide, and you have to figure out by yourself. If you're playing, you know, a G chord in third position against open strings, you can find a lot of inharmonic pitches that are either fretted or open, and you have to listen very carefully. But it was interesting this morning's presentation on Robert Johnson. I was just listening to how many times, and Big Bill Brunsey was really good at this too, in a regular pattern, his thumb would actually strike two to three strings at once, and it created this chuff. You know, you could hear an E, but there was also something else, and that's idiosyncratic to their own individual styles. But notating that is sometimes a little verbose. But I think the way we approach it is we're going for the uncompressed version before we even think about what the compressed version looks like. And I think I've seen, this is not a, you know, an attack on anybody, but a lot of Reverend Gary Davis's music has been published, and I've just never been satisfied. It left me with more questions than answers. So I thought, why not try and do something a little different, and this is what we're up to with these recordings, specifically. So here is some analysis. Now, if you recall back to the video's form, this form is a lot different. Instrumental breaks. In the other version, there wasn't any. He omitted the verse about Samson and the jawbone. There's actually some new identifiers. I'm going to get this right yet. V4, C5. These are new sort of things for the vocabulary. And that's what we're starting to expand upon. You know, what is he likely to do? And when is it likely to happen? I always like this one. Where did I go? Okay. I always like this one, this V4 right here. It was like one of my favorite sort of riffs. And when I was playing through the song, I would just put it in arbitrarily. But when I actually went back and listened, it only occurs prior to the end of the verse. And it wasn't like it sounded bad or that I had committed some, you know, crime, but it was, I was assuming that I knew a little too much about it. And I felt like I was offending somebody, you know. I was starting to make decisions for the style before I had fully understood it. And I think eventually that's a good thing, but it also proved to me that I didn't know enough, because it just started to sound, a little too predictable, actually. So I needed to build some vocabulary. And this is, the previous track was from the avant-garde. This is, So this is the first performance. This is actually his first song. And then here was different. Now here he's extended the instrumental break. Now the break itself is, I can't really put formal terms on it. It feels more like he's gone from 4-measure chunks of music to now 8 measures. And I won't understand that fully until I listen to or analyze all of his instrumental breaks to see if it comes up short or goes long. Is it going long by 4, or is it going long by 8? That'll tell me a little more. And then if he gets stuck somewhere, does he repeat something? Things like that. And that sort of helps me build the vocabulary as well. And then this is the last performance. And this one we're actually going to listen to in full, just because why the heck not? A lot of these recordings, I'll tell you, no one has ever listened to until we got our hands on them. They just sort of sat idly. And there are some major questions about what to do with them. And we just said, well, how's everything, as long as we can just, you know, do what we do with guitar music, which is usually, we try to make good decisions, ethical decisions, because we've, with Leo Kaki and Michael Hedges, those are far more sensitive areas. One, because Michael Hedges is no longer alive, and two, because a lot of those things that are captured are only captured because of the relationship between the person capturing and the person being captured. So it's not like open to, for the public kind of stuff. But so here is Reverend Gary Davis at the Avant-Garde. I had my way.
What happened then?
To say, there's a lot of study. You know, I'm just talking about the guitar end of it, but what really makes this difficult, and actually what really makes even someone like Robert Johnson's music difficult, especially his, is the cross or the independent rhythms of the lyric and the playing. With Gary Davis, the expressiveness and the variation and the amount of energy he could put behind vocals is very difficult to articulate, even in words, especially in words, actually, how to do it and what it means to that moment in the piece. Robert Johnson, not to talk too much more about him, but he was really good at totally different meter in the vocal. And most people struggle with that, just as most people, when it's like they can't do body halving. So their phrases end or start, it's fixated on a movement with the hand. It sort of lines up a little too conveniently. And that's one part of this that it is yet to be done. I think just in general, the collection is still growing. We just finished the gallery exhibition. And it, of course, brought all sorts of new things, like pictures, jackets, microphones. We got our hands on the original tape decks. You know, Gordy has the espresso machine, the cash register, the chairs, things like, and those are very interesting, and we just take it on. And but it's sort of unexpected too, from a collection standpoint. And I am not. I like stuff, and I, you know, try to file it as best I can, but. This is one end of it that I'm still having to learn about, and it's very difficult because it's happening much faster. It's happening in like the speed of real life. But so, are there any questions?
Actually, I have a couple questions.
Go ahead.
For you. One of them goes to content and looking through the list of the tunes that are on the tapes. Have you been able to listen to all of these?
Oh yeah.
Okay, then can you tell me if track 4, tape 13, side B, track 2. She's funny that way. Is that Gary Davis singing that old 30s pop tune?
Oh, yeah. I mean,
I'd love to hear that. And the other one down here in the next tape, Come Down and See Me Sometime.
Oh, that's one of my favorites. Yeah. And he actually, I think this was a normal practice. You can hear these in recordings that have been released from Gertie's Folk City, where he would incorporate, you know, as like a sing-along. It's what I learned pretty early about music and genres. Just throw them out the window. I was listening to an interview. Henrietta Yurchenko was interviewing Alan Lomax about the first time he met Leadbelly. So they recorded Goodnight Irene, but immediately he told Alan Lomax that he was trying to learn, That Silver-Haired Daddy of Mine by Gene Autry.
Yeah, he was big on Gene Autry,
Leadbelly. Yeah. I mean, the diversity in all of their repertoires is too much to associate with a single genre. So yes, he did. He covered it all.
And then you were talking about how some of the tapes are problematic. Your focus seems to be, you know, primarily on analyzing the guitar technique and making it available to others. Is there somebody there who's addressing the issue of tape preservation?
That'd be me.
And how's that going?
It's just swell. No, we lean on other departments. It's sort of this thing where you build up credibility and then you start firing your bullets when you need them. So the film department at UWM, which actually only deals in 16 millimeter, they were well set up to digitize the film and a few other things that we found, and we'll do more. But the composition technology department, they assist us a lot in just making sure things are in a safe place, properly stored. And then if we do need gear or help, I mean, these are people that are used to composing with tape as an active part of their performance. So it's a different perspective, but they're far more used to working with tape in strange ways. So they're well informed in how to deal with that stuff. I mean, I transfer analog tapes, but I am too nervous about, like, you know, pulling open the Gary Davis thing. Oh, we should just transfer it right now. It's a little more tenuous than that. But yeah, I mean, we house all of them.
Have you been able to take advantage of any of the expertise here at ARSC so far to give you a hand with that?
I'm new, so I'm...
Well, I urge you to do that, because we have several people who are dealing with similar issues,
yeah,
and may have conquered some of the things that you're looking at.
I think that's partially why I sought it out, because, you know, here are people that have dealt with a lot more in a lot stranger contexts, so...
That's great. Any other questions for Josh? Yes, okay, right over here. I'm hobbling as fast as I can.
I was just curious, have you talked to anybody at the archives department at UWM?
Well, I have a certain view of archives, sometimes they're good and sometimes they're too restrictive. And I think the infrastructure at the university right now it's a little too tight, because I think we are in conversation, but it's still a very difficult thing because there's so much of it that is still, in my mind, I still view us as like a holding cell. That's really a bad, but it's not ours. I mean, it still belongs to other people until they, you know, say this is, I mean, they have to tell us like 7 times, yes, you can keep this. But I still feel no ownership over anything, because it's too much of a gift to begin with to just sort of stumble on all of this. So the answer is yes, and we're just waiting. Because we have a certain vision as well, and it doesn't necessarily coincide. Now, the music librarian, Rebecca Littman, we talked to her about it, and because there's an organizational, I mean, just from a file system standpoint, there's a real, I can tell you that for the gallery show, we have the original scan, that's a file. We have the Photoshop file that's, you know, all the alterations. And then we have a print file for the thing that was actually shown in the gallery. So, I mean, it sort of cascades into things like that.
Thank you.
Steve? Number one, did you have a chance to come to the Robert Johnson session this morning?
Yes.
Okay, so I urge you to talk to Seth Winter. You saw the bald guy, and you know, you saw what he did with those, and he does amazing things. And we've got other people, Doug Pomeroy, and I think Rich will be more than happy, or I'll be more than happy to introduce you. But that's the reason you come to Arts Conference, yeah, is you meet these people. And I apologize I came in late on this, because we've got concurrent sessions. Are you making this available at all now in the state of which it is? Or you said you wanted people to hear it, that's what I thought.
That's a interesting issue. We haven't pushed it too much. There's a lot of ownership issues, and the owner of the physical tape is deceased. So we're working with actually his estate, just for permission to have it. But it's not like, we definitely want people to hear it, because I think it's great. Some of the performances are just astounding. And that's an objective statement, because I listen to a lot, not just of Gary Davis, but of Magic Sam and Big Joe. But we don't know. There's certain legal issues, and some of it has been attempted to be sold. I think part of the Magic Sam, Del Mar has just picked up on it, at least one of the performances. We don't know what's going to happen.
Well, I encourage you to, even before you clean it up, mm-hmm, to just make sure you've got it digitized and preservation copies. And usually lawyers or the families are more than happy to let you at least make your copy there, whether it gets out. At least that's solved. Yeah. Then work through the other stuff. But I'd love to be able to hear some of this stuff, especially what Rich has been reading off that list.
Are there any other questions? All right, well, thank you very much. We want to thank all of our speakers. This was certainly an interesting afternoon, and we look forward to more and great things from all of them. Thank you very much. Thank you.